In many Unitarian congregations, I hear people talking about wanting to be more diverse, often in terms of being more multicultural, racially diverse, and in terms of sexual orientation and gender identity, among other ways of describing our human diversities. On the back of your order of service, I see in your congregation's mission statement, I think that's on the back, how Beacon embraces diversity and celebrates each individual search for truth. I've heard some Unitarians say, why doesn't our congregation look more like the larger community where we're located? Perhaps it's a question you've heard even in this congregation. Of course, this congregation, like many Unitarian congregations, does have diversity in these various areas. But sometimes we don't mirror the culture, the society where we are. So how do we make this happen? How do we make ourselves so available that anyone who feels drawn to us feels welcome? Well, I believe by looking at how we presently treat each other, before we make a concerted effort to invite all those around us to join us, we begin by learning what the culture, the kinds of culture is in the congregation that we presently have, so that we can then welcome other cultures knowingly. We're happy, of course, to have newcomers with us today. And I think Unitarians also need to do our homework. We begin with our values and principles. At the root of the first Unitarian principle is the concept that each person has worth just because they're a human being. We also believe that each person has a right to explore how they make meaning out of what happens to them and how to express themselves in the world, as long as how they express themselves isn't harming others or themselves. Now, this kind of thing seems like it's good in theory, but it can get messy and uncomfortable when we encounter differences between us. When we aim to be fair and compassionate in how we relate to one another, we may think of a guide such as the Golden Rule: do to others what you would have them do to you. When I read on the back of your order of service, I see in the first line of your covenant, we promise to welcome each other as we would wish to be welcomed. Now, on the whole, the Golden Rule is a useful guide, but it also has its limitations. If that other person is a lot like you, then you may have an idea whether what you like is something they would like. But how does this rule consider the differences among us culturally? What if how you like to be treated is not a way that I'm comfortable with or is acceptable to me? And what if I try to impose my way of living on you? There are limitations to this rule. Philosopher and free thinker Ali Sina explains, the Golden Rule does not mean do to others exactly what you like to be done to you. For example, if you like peanut butter, like in the story today, it doesn't mean you feed it to someone who's allergic to it and could kill them. It doesn't mean that you should take your wife, who likes concerts, to a basketball game because you like basketball. Or invite your Hindu friend to a barbecue because you're a meat eater and you know he's a vegetarian. It comes back, of course, to considering how your action might be received by that other person. That's what inspired me to choose this particular Far Side cartoon that you might have seen on the front of the order of service. Our human diner obviously is not very conscious of the fact his fellow diners are chickens and pigs. So when he orders, well, I guess I'll have the ham and eggs, he's not considering the impact on those around him. I'd like to talk to you today about a platinum rule: treat others as they want to be treated. It's about not only imagining yourselves in their shoes, but actually getting to know what another person likes and how they feel. It's about becoming more aware of who you are and how you behave in the world and what that says about how you understand the world. When each of us becomes more aware of these things, we can begin to understand how others may perceive the world from their life experience and culture. To explore the Platinum Rule today, I want to first consider what happens when it's not lived out. Then I want to talk a bit about my experience trying to live out this Platinum Rule. When the Platinum Rule is not lived out individual to individual, such as serving meat to a vegetarian, these kinds of differences can be identified, explored, and negotiated. But when that golden rule that we talked about is actually applied by a dominant group of people who think that they know what's best for a minority group, this can lead to disastrous results. A case in point, the way the Canadian government treated Aboriginal people in this country, and still do. As many of you know, but for those who may not be familiar with some of these facts, during the formation of this country, the Canadian government and many Canadians saw Aboriginal people as less than they were, uncivilized according to the rules of the civilization by which they judged, not valuing the civilizations Aboriginal people came from. In an ill-conceived move, the government set up schools that Aboriginal children were required to attend and where they had to reside. The purpose of these schools was to get children away from their families and communities, to kill the culture they were raised in, and to instill in them a Eurocentric worldview and a religion that the government deemed superior to theirs. The government thought this would lead Aboriginals to become farmers and therefore recognized as contributing members of society according to how the government saw it. By the 1850s, the government's official policy was the assimilation of Aboriginal people into mainstream society. I read this. When religious orders had been operating such schools before Confederation, they had been, sorry, while they'd been doing that in 1867, it was not until the 1880s that the federal government fully embraced the residential school model for Aboriginal education. While the government began to close the schools in the 1970s, the last school remained in operation until 1996. That's not long ago. In that time, over 100 years, at least 150,000 Aboriginal children went through the residential school system. I imagine most of you have heard about these schools in the news or read a book about them. Perhaps you've seen something like the National Film Board documentary, We Were Children. I recommend it to you. Of course, there were terrible physical, emotional, and often sexual abuse that these children experienced. Not all of the children suffered extreme abuse, but many did. Some did have positive experiences, but all experienced the trauma of being torn from their families and deprived of their cultures, languages, spiritual traditions, and communities. The government began to contract out the running of these schools to the Roman Catholic Church, the United Church, and the Anglican Church. By 1920, residential school attendance for Aboriginal children between the ages of 7 to 15 was mandatory. Some children were put there before when they were even younger, and some stayed a few years later as well. The children's parents would have been put in jail if they refused to send their children. Nonetheless, some did secret their children away from their communities so that Indian Affairs agents couldn't hear about the children and then send them away. Many children in residential schools were kept away for 10 months of the year. Some who lived in remote areas were kept away the whole year, year after year. Besides the obvious attempt at cultural genocide, there were at least 3,000 deaths of children at residential schools, according to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's Missing Children Project. Many of those deaths were due to ill health that came from overcrowding, underfunding, poor nutrition and sanitation, and inadequate medical care. For those who contracted tuberculosis, it went untreated, and many died as a result. Others died from influenza. Some argue it was not just cultural genocide, but a willful negligence, a disregard for the basic worth and dignity of these children. You might have heard the revelations this summer about the nutritional experiments done on over 1,000 children in residential schools, six of them, during the 1940s and 50s. We have not even begun to understand the impact of those experiments, which no doubt changed many lives, not just during those years, but throughout their life. It took until the 1980s and 90s until those who committed the abuses against these children were taken to court. In 2005, the Assembly of First Nations started what ended up being the biggest class action suit in Canadian history. In 2006, the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement was created between the legal representatives of former students, the Assembly of First Nations, Inuit representatives, the federal government, and the churches. In September 2007, the federal government and the churches involved agreed to pay individual and collective compensation to residential school survivors. The government also pledged to take measures and support healing, and to establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. As the chair of the commission, Justice Murray Sinclair reminded us in the opening ceremonies of the TRC's BC event, that is the Truth and Reconciliation BC event, this past September, that the commission isn't just a government initiative. It is a commission created by and responsible to report to all parties of the settlement. Now, I feel very fortunate that I was able to attend some of those events. I learned some things about residential schools over the years before that, reading from various sources and talking to some survivors, but I knew there was so much more I still needed to learn. There was a reason I began thinking about how the Platinum Rule applies to the Indian Residential School. I first heard about the Platinum Rule earlier this year, along with other Unitarian Universalist ministers in North America. We're doing a program called Who Are Our Neighbors? We're exploring how we understand culture and working toward greater competency with intercultural communication. It's helping us become more self-aware in how we relate to people from cultures different than those each of us come from. The model we're looking at comes from the work of Milton J. Bennett, a sociologist and intercultural communications researcher. In Bennett's words, "After years of observing all kinds of people, I wanted to explain why some people seem to get a lot better at communicating across cultural boundaries, while other people didn't improve at all. And I thought that if I were able to explain why this happened, trainers and educators could do a better job of preparing people for cross-cultural encounter." Bennett and others did research in various countries around the world. What they found was there was a spectrum of how people respond to different cultures. For ease of understanding, Bennett put it into a model of intercultural sensitivity, looking at how we as humans fall into a bell curve of ways that we relate to others. To simplify this more complex model, I'll briefly describe the basic idea from these seven approaches. There is a denial that differences exist for some. And then there are those who are defensive, saying there's them and us, and we know the right way, often stereotyping the others. Now, where most of us humans sit in this model is at the top of the bell curve in a state of what he calls minimization, believing basically that we humans are all the same, minimizing the differences that do exist. Someone from this perspective might say, oh sure, we may eat different foods or dress differently, but really when you get to know them, they are really like us. They're not yet aware how to detect the difference. Then there are those who have developed a more nuanced way of viewing culture, who can accept that there are differences in how people and groups see the world. They recognize that values and behavior can be understood differently depending on the context. They're curious to know more about other cultures. It doesn't mean they agree with everything they find, but they see them as viable ways of seeing the world. Then there are those who adapt to other cultures, being able to feel comfortable moving within other cultural contexts and behave in culturally appropriate ways. Of course, then at the end of that bell curve, there are those able to integrate more than one way of being, who are bicultural or multicultural, who can move between cultures easily. For those who are interested more in this model, I've left a one-page handout that our ushers will have available to you after the service. And feel free to talk to me or Deborah Thorne, your minister, about. In the process of learning about the Indian residential schools, I could see how these ways of relating culture to culture have applied. The government really was in a defensive relationship to the various Aboriginal cultures. The government thought their Eurocentric worldview and ways of being were superior. If Bennett's model is statistically accurate, then many non-Aboriginals in Canada are still in minimization. Aboriginal people are just like us once you get to know them. Now, it's not to say that I, as a non-Aboriginal person, don't have things in common with some Aboriginal people. I do. I have with some and less so with others, as is true with individuals who come from various cultural backgrounds. But what Bennett is getting at is how well is someone actually able to distinguish both the similarities and differences between the groups. If I can't see the differences, then I am likely to recommit that golden rule limitation and assume that someone will see things as I see them and will want to live as I will live rather than how they want to live. Because of this intercultural competency work, when I went to the TRC event, I encouraged myself to be curious, to put myself out there and not take myself so seriously. So if I made a mistake, to apologize and seek to get to know the other person's perspective. I figured just taking one step after another along the path to becoming more aware of how I relate to people is the way to go. There are all kinds of human cultures that exist, whether sexual orientation, gender identity, ethnicities, abilities. There are so many different ways of being human. I got to apply some of these insights in how I was trying to live the platinum rule, treating others as they want to be treated. And I was able to begin to see more clearly the effects on a massive scale when that doesn't happen group to group or individual to individual. There are two brief stories I want to share with you. The first I heard at the public sharing that some survivors did with the commission members. The man who was sharing was a professional who'd had many successes in his life. He had grown up in a residential school. He said that like others who had spoken that day before him, he too had experienced various types of abuses during his time growing up in the school. What he wanted to talk about, however, was the impact that these schools had on their communities. What I remember him saying are words to this effect. When I think of when I was taken away as a young child, it didn't have a big impact on my community. It had an impact on my immediate family, and it had a devastating impact on me and my life. But the loss of one child in a community wasn't really going to be noticed over the long run. But when you consider the loss of all the children, generation after generation, it collapsed our society and our community's way of being. The impact of the residential schools was immense, is immense on Aboriginal communities like this man's all over the country. It will take more than a few generations for the healing. the cycles of abuse, addiction, and dysfunction that I heard various survivors talk about continue through the generations, begun by the abuses done to Aboriginal people through the Indian residential school system. What kind of loss also did it mean for Canada as a country? Can you imagine what it would have been like if such damage had not been done to the many Aboriginal communities all over Canada? What would have been the additional contributions of Aboriginal people to our country's culture, values, the arts, economy, and our spiritual understanding of how we live together? It's mind-boggling to imagine. Here's my second story. One day I took part in a dialogue circle sponsored by the organization Reconciliation Canada that's based here in Vancouver. We each went around sharing our names, our cultural backgrounds, and where we had come from. Near the end of the circle, there was one non-Aboriginal woman who spoke of the shame she felt about what had happened. A few people later, an elder spoke. As a survivor, and she believed the other survivors would feel the same, she did not want other people to feel shame. She said, "We are just so grateful that you are all here. All we want is for you to hear our stories, to hear what happened to us, so that it won't be forgotten." I had amazing experiences at the TRC event, so many I won't go on into them today. These experiences helped me learn more about what happened in what is truly part of our shared Canadian history. And for healing to happen, I have to get involved. How can we now in Canada, between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, move from the past's misguided interpretation of the Golden Rule to learning how to live the Platinum Rule, treating others as they want to be treated? Here's how I realize I need to get involved. I need to hold the government to account to fulfill their part of the residential school settlement agreement. I need to stand together with Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals to help protect the earth. And I need to continue to learn to recognize the differences between us as people and peoples, and not be shy about those differences, not be overcome by white shame of saying or doing the wrong thing, but to approach differences with curiosity and open-mindedness. It's more than just about acknowledging difference. It can be about the gifts that other cultures can offer me, to see with wonder the myriad ways there are to be human. What can help me with this? Well, the training that I'm doing with fellow ministers that I hope some of you will also learn from in future. We have various diversities in culture in Canada. It's time to make more changes, especially in the relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, and, of course, between us all in all our cultural diversities. Once we understand how to become more interculturally competent, we can apply this to the various ways we are together. In the words of Chief Dr. Robert Joseph, who helped found Reconciliation Canada, "Let us find a way to belong in this time and place together. The future and the well-being of all our children rests with the kind of relationships that we build today." So might it be.